Support for Yale Cancer Answers comes from AstraZeneca, committed to pioneering the next generation of innovative lung cancer treatments. Learn more at AstraZeneca-US.com. Welcome to Yale Cancer Answers with Drs. Anish Chagpar and Stephen Gore. I'm Bruce Barber. Yale Cancer Answers features the latest information on cancer care by welcoming oncologists and specialists who are on the forefront of the battle to fight cancer. This week, it's a conversation about surgical care for lung cancer with Dr. Andrew Dhanasapan. Dr. Dhanasapan is an assistant professor of thoracic surgery at the Yale School of Medicine, and Dr. Chagpar is a professor of surgery at Yale and the assistant director for global oncology at Yale Comprehensive Cancer Center.
Andrew, maybe we can start off by setting the stage. Tell me about lung cancer. How common is it? Who gets it? What stage does it present at? That kind of thing.
So lung cancer is the number one cause of cancer death in the United States. Most of the time we associate patients with lung cancer, folks who have smoking history, but also people who have not smoked do develop lung cancer as well. Several years ago, there was a national lung cancer screening trial that was published in the New England Journal of Medicine 2011, in which they demonstrated for folks who are between the ages of 55 to 74 years, have had a prior smoking history of 30 pack years, meaning about a pack a day for 30 years, or those who have quit within the past 15 years. Those people who have had yearly lung cancer, yearly CT scans, they found lung cancers in those folks and were able to show a reduction in lung cancer death by 20%, a relative risk reduction. At Yale, we have a lung cancer screening program that allows us to detect lung cancer earlier.
So, Andrew, let's talk a little bit about finding these lung cancers. I mean, certainly lung cancer is something that everybody's heard about, and everybody knows that it's bad. I think a few questions I have. The first is that we often put lung cancer together with smoking, and even the screening program that you described really puts an emphasis on smoking. But you mentioned that people who have never smoked can also get lung cancer. So how do you know what to watch for? Like, what are the symptoms that you would present with? I think that, you know, if you have been a smoker for a long time, you might be more thinking about lung cancer. But certainly if you've never touched a cigarette in your life, it's not something that's going to be top of mind. So what are the symptoms that people should be looking for?
Right. One aspect that we look at when evaluating patients for lung cancer is also family history. In addition to a personal family history, we also ask symptoms such as cough, any coughing up of blood-tinged sputum. Sometimes wheezing can also be a indicator. Obviously, these are very generic and very common symptoms. When we evaluate patients, in addition to the symptoms, we do take into account a variety of other those other factors into the determination of how likely this person has a lung cancer. Often, lung cancers are detected on a CT scan that is found incidentally for a variety of other reasons that patients may get CT scans. And that sort of begins the workup of lung cancer.
So I want to unpack that just a little bit more, because as a lifetime non-smoker, I'm sitting here thinking, I've had a cough before, and I can wheeze when it's cold outside and I've run up 10 flights of stairs. hopefully that doesn't mean that I've got lung cancer. So help me to understand, when should people be going to the doctor? I mean, when should we be kind of saying, hey, I might need a CT scan?
Right.
Are we sure that I don't have lung cancer and not just, you know, exercise-induced asthma due to cold?
Right.
Or something.
Of course. And when, as I had mentioned, for folks who have had a smoking history, that's the number one thing that raises the suspicion level. For the less common situation where folks who have had a cough for a period of time that has not gotten better with a course of antibiotics or the traditional therapies for cough, and an X-ray is done, for example, by a primary care physician that shows a spot that hasn't gone away for a period of time. Those are some situations where that would raise the suspicion to, for example, get a CT scan to follow that.
And the other question that I have is, you know, I think now we know, and it's a bona fide truth and everybody knows it, that smoking causes cancer. I don't think that anybody can say that that's fake news. But what is also true is that it is incredibly hard to quit smoking. So I have two questions for you. The first question is, if you manage to quit smoking, do you actually reduce your lung cancer risk? And then the second question, which may be more difficult, is how exactly does one go about quitting smoking?
Right. So quitting smoking is one of the most difficult things that anyone can do. We often counsel our patients in clinic that if they do quit smoking, it is, of course, beneficial to their health. They do still have that inherent risk of lung cancer because of the history of smoking, but they would be able to improve their future health by quitting smoking.
But they're still at risk?
They are still at risk.
Because even in the screening trial, even if you've quit less than 15 years ago, you're still considered high risk.
Exactly.
But you know what, Andrew? Some people are going to be listening to this going, well, then why should I quit smoking?
Right, right. So quitting smoking has numerous health benefits aside from the respiratory aspect. It affects the cardiovascular system, which is the number one cause of health-related hospitalizations in the United States. For the general health benefits of quitting smoking, we do recommend that. But you are correct that just having had smoking in the past, that is your risk of lung cancer.
So I guess the key message there is to anyone who is listening who hasn't started, don't. Because if you do start, it's kind of with you for life. It's kind
exactly.
of like... It's kind of like the scarlet letter that you can't get rid of.
Right. And at Yale, we have a smoking cessation program that helps folks quit smoking. They are often with us in our clinics and can counsel patients on a variety of methods. We all know these over-the-counter products that are in the forms of gums or medications that can help with reducing the cravings for smoking.
All right. So let's say you have been a smoker, you're trying to quit, or maybe you have quit, and you develop a cough that doesn't go away, and you're coughing up blood, and you go to your family doctor, and they get a chest X-ray, and lo and behold, it finds a spot. And because of your history, your doctor's worried and sends you to see a specialist. Take me through kind of how lung cancer is diagnosed.
Right. So if a patient has high risk characteristics, as you mentioned, and there's a spot on a chest X-ray, the next step is to obtain a CT scan, a diagnostic CT scan that will help better characterize this spot in the lung. On the CT scan, the radiologist would be able to describe the spot. Often it's in terms of the size, the morphology, meaning is it a smooth border? Is it a what we call spiculated or irregular borders? Is it solid? Is it not so solid or subsolid? So there are a lot of characteristics from the CT scan that we can obtain. And based on the level of suspicion for this nodule, then there are several ways to then work this up. Patients often get a PET scan. A PET scan is different from a CAT scan in the sense that the PET scan shows metabolic activity of areas of the body. For example, a cancer that is metabolically very active, the cells are actively dividing, will show up as being very bright on the PET scan. if the CT scan has high-risk features, if the PET scan shows that this is bright, this is, would be concerning for lung cancer. Depending on the location of the nodule, this could be biopsied in a variety of ways. The most common way is a CT-guided biopsy. This is an outpatient procedure. It's done under local anesthesia. And under CT guidance, a needle is passed into the nodule to obtain cells to examine under the microscope.
So let me get this straight. You do a CT scan, you see a lump or a mass, and it's spiculated, and you're worried about it, and the patient's been a smoker, and you're thinking this might be a cancer. You then do a PET scan that lights up, but then you still do a biopsy to prove that it's a cancer. So my question is, do you really need the biopsy, or did you really need the PET scan? Because it sounds like either way, you're going to need some sort of test to confirm that it's a cancer, but do you need both?
Right. So in the workup of lung cancer, a PET scan is often helpful to not only look at the lung nodule, but to examine the rest of the body to see if there's any spread, any activity elsewhere that looks suspicious. So there, that would be another reason to obtain a PET scan. You're right in that the CT-guided biopsy is not always necessary. If the CT scan and the PET scan look suspicious enough, patients then can be referred to the appropriate specialist to go ahead with a particular treatment depending on what preliminary stage or clinical stage that this seems to be.
So let's go there then. Tell me about the staging of lung cancer. What exactly, what are the factors that go into that? How do you figure out what stage you are? And how does the treatment vary by stage?
Right. So as in with other cancers, the staging for lung cancer follows a stage 1, 2, 3, and 4. And within each stage, that is determined by the what we have a classification for, the TNM stage. That's tumor, node, and metastasis. So for lung cancer, the T aspect refers to the size of the nodule. The N, or the nodes, refers to the involvement of any of the surrounding lymph nodes. And the M refers to the determination if there are any metastases throughout the rest of the body. For stages 1 and 2, surgery is the first step in treatment for lung cancer.
And so presumably for the others, there's other modalities. So I would like to pick up on that conversation and talk more about the treatment of different stages of lung cancer. Where does surgery play a role? Where does medicine play a role? Right after we take a short break for a medical minute. Please stay tuned to learn more about the surgical care of lung cancer with my guest, Dr. Andrew Dhanasopan.
Support for Yale Cancer Answers comes from AstraZeneca, now offering 3 FDA-approved therapies for different forms of lung cancer, with more in the pipeline. When it comes to lung cancer treatment, one size does not fit all. Learn more at AstraZeneca-US.com. This is a Medical Minute about pancreatic cancer, which represents about 3% of all cancers in the U.S. and about 7% of cancer deaths. Clinical trials are currently being offered at federally designated comprehensive cancer centers for the treatment of advanced stage and metastatic pancreatic cancer using chemotherapy and other novel therapies. FOLFIRINOX, a combination of five different chemotherapies, is the latest advance in the treatment of metastatic pancreatic cancer, and research continues at centers around the world looking into targeted therapies and a recently discovered marker, HENT1. This has been a Medical Minute brought to you as a public service by Yale Cancer Center. More information is available at yalecancercenter.org. You're listening to Connecticut Public Radio.
This is Dr. Anish Chagpar, and I'm joined tonight by my guest, Dr. Andrew Dhanasopan. We're discussing surgical care of patients with lung cancer, and right before the break, Andrew was talking to us about how lung cancer is staged. And very much like other cancers that we've talked about on this show, we use this TNM staging system. How big is the cancer, the tumor, T? Does it look like the lymph nodes are involved, N? And are there distant metastases or spread throughout the body, M? Now, it seems to me, Andrew, that a lot of that information you're going to get based on the PET scan that you said that you would get and the CT scan.
Right.
And so how do we really divide people up? So stage four in many cancers is spread to distant organs. Is that the case in lung cancer too?
Right, correct.
And so how is that treated? Does surgery play a role there or no?
Surgery at this stage does not play a direct role with stage four. At Yale, we are considering certain very select groups of people with stage four disease for surgical treatment, for which we're developing clinical pathways and potential trials in the future. But as a gold standard in throughout the United States, stage four is treated with chemotherapy and immunotherapy.
So the reason for that really is because it's got distant spread, and surgery can't really treat distant metastasis.
Right. We think of distant spread as a systemic issue. We think of surgery as treating a locally contained cancer. And so for systemic disease, systemic treatments like chemotherapy and immunotherapy would be helpful.
So tell me more about surgery in the metastatic setting, because certainly in a number of cancers, people have started wondering about whether there is a role for surgery of the primary disease, in some cancers even of the metastases, in stage four disease. So tell me more about this study that is going on at Yale, or the pathway that you're developing, because I think that is interesting and certainly something that we think about in breast cancer as well.
Right. This is a very exciting, very new topic in which we are selecting for patients who, for example, have a lung nodule, who do not have any other spread except for perhaps a small number or just one spot of metastasis, for example, in the brain. I actually did have a patient like that a few weeks ago who I operated on. She was a middle-aged woman, prior smoker, had a small 1 centimeter nodule in the lung, but had two additional nodules in the brain. Now, the brain metastases were treated with radiation. And once she was determined to not have any further progression of the disease there, she was then referred to surgery to consider surgical resection of the primary nodule in the lung. She did well after her lung surgery, was able to go home after day three, and she's so far done very well.
Yeah. So interesting because, you know, previously we would say to people, you know, if you've got distant metastatic disease, there really isn't much we can do for you locally. And yet, you know, that local primary might be the only site that really is left after people have treated with systemic therapy, small clusters of disease in single organs. So really exciting work there. And certainly something that we talk about in colorectal cancer, where it's now become standard of care that you can resect not only the primary, but, you know, up to four liver metastases has become pretty standard and something that we're working on to really figure out in breast cancer as well. So let's talk now about the other stages. So stage, if we look at the other end of the spectrum, stage one, tell me about what that is. Is that cancer that has no lymph nodes?
Correct. So stage one lung cancer involves just the primary site of the lung cancer within a particular region of the lung without any involvement of any lymph nodes.
And so how are those treated?
Those are treated with surgery.
And surgery alone, so no immunotherapy, no chemotherapy, no radiation, no nothing, just surgery?
Correct. Surgery is the gold standard treatment for stage one lung cancer. There are, throughout the country, starting to be trials looking at if they're if immunotherapy combined with surgery would be even more effective. But as of right now, the gold standard is surgery for stage one.
And what's the prognosis of stage one patients who are treated with surgery?
For stage one lung cancer, it depends on the particular division within the stage one. There are a few subdivisions in stage one, but in general, and we talk about 5-year survivals on the order of the high 70s to 90s.
Okay. And when you talk about different divisions, tell me about that. What do you mean?
Sure. For example, in stage one, there's 1A and 1B. Within stage, within 1A, there's 1A1, 1A2, 1A3.
Oh, jeepers.
There are a few different subdivisions depending on basically the size of the tumor.
Okay. So people are just trying to mince the salami really, really thinly.
Exactly.
I see. Okay. And so in terms of surgery, I mean, I remember back in the good old days, you know, people who underwent lung surgery, I mean, this was really big surgery. I mean, a stem to stern kind of cut around the side. And, you know, opening up, spreading ribs, maybe even taking a rib or two, and doing major resections, people staying in hospital with chest tubes and things like that. But these days, I mean, especially in some cancers, I mean, the urology people doing prostate cancers have now really used robotic surgery. Tell me about advances in surgical treatment for lung cancer. Where are we with that?
Right. Over the past 20 years, there has been rapid development of minimally invasive techniques to treat lung cancers. 20 years ago, this was mirroring the development of laparoscopic surgery, which is what I tell a lot of my patients who know more about laparoscopic surgery than what we do, which is thoracoscopic surgery or VATS, video-assisted thoracoscopic surgery. It uses the same basic technology, small cameras on the order of 5 millimeters in width, as well as small instruments to go in between the ribs instead of, as you were saying, cutting muscle in between the ribs and spreading the ribs and what we call a thoracotomy. So with VATS, that has helped patients to have less pain after surgery, to have a decreased length of stay in the hospital, and to return to work and life earlier than with a big open surgery. In the past 10 years, there has been development of robotic surgery, as you mentioned, which essentially is a minimally invasive tool, just like VATS. However, the ability to use instruments in a way that's different than VATS allows for better enhancement of manual dexterity and very fine and minute dissection around the critical small structures that are required to do lung surgery.
So just to be clear, I mean, because sometimes when we talk about robotic surgery, the image that people get is, you know, you've got these little robots inside of you that are doing the surgery. I mean, it's still a surgeon sitting at a console using this robot-like technology to do this surgery, right?
Absolutely. The surgeon is at a console next to the OR table. There is an assistant at the OR table with the patient. The robotic aspect of it refers to the arms of the robotic platform that is used to perform the maneuvers. However, the surgeon is in complete control of the instruments as he or she uses it in the operation.
So it sounds like you now have more tools in your armamentarium. So you can do the big open thoracotomy. You can do the minimally invasive VATS, which allows you to do a smaller procedure but might not give you all of the dexterity of the third option, which is the robotic surgery. So what's the breakdown in terms of lung cancer surgery between the three modalities?
Right. So, for example, at Yale, we do over 90% of our lung cancer operations minimally invasively, either by VATS or by robotic surgery. Robotic surgery does require additional training. And so about 25 to 30% of our cases that are minimally invasive are done robotically.
And so is there less, because of the greater ability for surgeons to have more dexterity and so on and so forth, is robotic surgery, quote, better, unquote? I mean, would you have less blood loss, shorter operative time, shorter length of stay? Or is it really just that the surgeon can manipulate the arms of the device a little bit better?
Right. I think throughout the country, we're still trying to figure out if robotic surgery, it does in fact translate into those important patient-related outcomes that are better than VAT surgery. As of right now, both are viewed as better than open thoracotomies, big incisions, in terms of allowing patients to recover quicker and return to work faster.
And so, so are there certain patients that you would say you would advocate more for one option versus the other?
At this point, not necessarily. I think it's ultimately up to the comfort level of the surgeon. I think that the important thing is that minimally invasive surgery is offered. I think if the surgeon has been well-trained in robotic surgery and they're more comfortable with approaching this robotically, then that is a fantastic way to go. I think that if the surgeon does VAT surgery, I think that's also a great modality to use. The key point is that choose a surgeon that is trained in some minimally invasive platform.
So good questions to ask your surgeon when you meet your surgeon as to, you know, what techniques they feel comfortable using and what technology is available at your particular hospital.
Absolutely.
So in our last minute, Andrew, you know, we talked about the metastatic setting where patients get systemic therapy and now maybe surgery, clinical trials pending. And we talked about early breast cancer stage one where they get surgery alone. What about that gray zone in stage two to three? Give me kind of the Cole's Notes version of how those patients get treated.
Right. Stage two patients tend to have some spread of the cancer to local lymph nodes. And often that is discovered after the operation. Once the tumor and the lymph nodes are sent off to the pathology lab, sometimes what happens is we do determine their lymph node involvement. In those cases, we have patients see a medical oncologist for consideration of chemotherapy.
First, before surgery?
After surgery.
Okay. And then stage three, the same?
For stage three is a controversial field in which we're trying to figure out which patients benefit from which treatment first. A common pathway for these patients in which they have involvement of the lymph nodes, not near the tumor, but closer to the middle of the chest. Those patients tend to undergo chemotherapy and radiation first before undergoing surgery.
Dr. Andrew Dhanasapan is an assistant professor of thoracic surgery at the Yale School of Medicine. If you have questions, the address is canceranswers@yale.edu, and past editions of the program are available in audio and written form at yalecancercenter.org. I'm Bruce Barber, reminding you to tune in each week to learn more about the fight against cancer here on Connecticut Public Radio.